So before I get started, I have no financial disclosures to disclose, no financial relationships to disclose. What I want to talk to everyone in the room today about is just to introduce the Superfund program and CERCLA, the law that authorizes the Superfund program. Talk about the public involvement opportunities we have throughout the Superfund cleanup process, discuss the resources that we have for public involvement, and then shift gears a little bit to talk specifically about public involvement in the baseline human health risk assessment process that happens in Superfund, and then to showcase some resources we have for that public involvement process. I think most people in this room are very familiar with the history of Superfund, but in 1980, Congress established the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, known as CERCLA, amended in 1986. And the act was passed in response to a growing concerns over health and environmental risks posed by hazardous waste sites. So the picture on your right is a picture of Love Canal, and most people are very familiar with the site in Niagara Falls, New York, which was basically built on top of a landfill. And there was a bunch of public outcry, media attention towards the site. And this site and the community around the site really petitioned Congress and was the reason why they passed CERCLA to begin with. When CERCLA was originally passed, Congress intended the responsibility of cleanup activities to be borne on rested on the polluters who created the contamination to begin with. We call those potentially responsible parties. So it's a polluter pays type of regulation. And historically, the Superfund program was funded through a tax placed on chemical and petroleum industries, and this tax enabled a large fund, a trust fund, which hence the name Superfund. So we pulled from that Superfund to start cleaning up contamination, and then we went after the potentially responsible parties to help to pay back the agency for the cleanups that we had initiated. Today, the polluter still pays whenever we can find them, but the remainder of the funds comes from taxpayer revenue through a line item through Congress. The tax on petroleum and chemical industries has expired, so we're working off of revenue from Congress. The Superfund program is administered by EPA in cooperation with state and tribal agencies. CERCLA, the passage of the law, enabled the revision of the National Oil Hazardous Substances and Pollution Contingency Plan, which is typically talked about as the National Contingency Plan, or the NCP, which are the regulations that we promulgate CERCLA with. And also Superfund sites when they're listed on the national priority list. The process is defined in the National Contingency Plan. Since 1980, we've had over 1,600 sites listed on the national priority list. They represent all 50 states, including Puerto Rico, D.C., Guam, and the Virgin Islands. In 1983, we listed the Love Canal site, and since then, approximately 950 families were relocated from the site while we were doing cleanup on the site, some of them relocated permanently. So one thing that I really want to impart and try to let people know is that CERCLA and the Superfund program is very unique. And what makes it unique is that written into the law, Congress authorized public involvement opportunities. So it's very different than other environmental statutes. They specifically writ in that the public has a right to be involved in the decision-making process. So with that, written into our regulations that promulgate the law are specific public involvement activities that are required throughout the Superfund process. And also we have policies and guidance that back up the regulations. And we also therefore develop programs to help folks go beyond just the requirements of public involvement and really create robust, meaningful public involvement opportunities around specific Superfund sites. So the National Contingency Plan is written into a very step-by-step process to clean up a site. On the left-hand side, you'll see what we talk about as major technical milestones in the Superfund cleanup process, starting with placing a site on the national priorities list and moving all the way through deleting the site once it's been completely cleaned up and there's absolutely no risks to human health and the environment. On the right side are required public involvement activities throughout the cleanup process. All of these activities are either written into the National Contingency Plan, so the regulations that show us how to clean up sites, or with operation and maintenance, they're written into our guidance documents. So what I wanted to showcase a couple of the required public involvement opportunities. So what's unique that we have a public involvement program, we actually have folks in the regional offices whose sole job is to work on community involvement around a cleanup of sites. So our community involvement staff really strive to keep the community well informed of planned and ongoing activities. And you'll note the requirements for Federal Register notices and press releases throughout the Superfund cleanup process. They encourage and enable community members to get involved, and you'll see requirements for community interviews and developing a community involvement plan, as well as marketing technical assistance grant opportunities in the remedial investigation and feasibility study stage of the Superfund cleanup process. Community involvement staff strive to listen very carefully to what community is saying and change planned cleanup activities when community comments or concerns have merit. So we release our plan of action of how we're going to clean up the site, and then we have to hold public meetings to get feedback on that plan of action, and then develop a responsiveness summary to showcase how we've responded to those comments, and that's part of the official decision document, the record of decision. And then we also strive to explain to the community what EPA has done and why. So every single Superfund site is required to have an information repository, which houses all the decision documents for the site, as well as other fact sheets, briefings, any other outreach activity that the agency has created. So it's all in one place for a community member to go and look at. So I've already explained that the public involvement in the Superfund program is required by law. I think a lot of people in this room would also agree that engaging citizens in decisions that affect their lives is just the right thing to do. We live in a democracy. But even beyond that, beyond those two reasons, involving the public in our assessment and management of hazardous waste cleanup sites allows the agency to make better decisions. Community members often have important information that improve the accuracy of our site characterization and the baseline human health risk assessment. So community knowledge, local knowledge, is something someone noted in the session prior to this, can help the site team better understand the site's history, the type and the extent of contamination. Was there midnight dumping that the agency's not aware of? Is the contamination in a different place than the agency's looking? Community knowledge can help the site team more accurately characterize exposure pathways due to human behavior. Are there unique exposure pathways going on in the community that we're unaware about? Community local knowledge can help develop appropriate cleanup approaches that identify suitable future land uses. How does the community want to use the land? Do they want to use it as a playground, recreational opportunities? Do they want to use it as a parking lot? Our process needs to foresight how the community wants to use the land. And also become aware of certain segments of the community that may have a disproportionate burden of exposure or vulnerable to certain exposure pathways. And my colleague and mentor, Dr. Sophia Cerda, risk assessor in Region 9, I think says it best when she basically points out to her management all the time that community input is required because it helps us produce results that are realistic, reasonable, and comprehensive. So as far as resources for community involvement that we make available to our site teams, we really focus on building capacity of the community and also building our staff capacity to do public involvement. So we have technical assistance grants, and this is a program that was actually written into our regulations, which are grants provided to nonprofit community organizations to have their own pot of money to hire a technical assistant advisor to help them understand complex Superfund technical documents. Technical assistance grants are federal grants, and they have the stipulations of grant funding that many in the audience are probably well aware of. And we've noticed that some communities don't have the capacity to actually handle a federal grant. So we've kind of created another opportunity for third-party technical assistance through a contract. So our Technical Assistance Services for Communities is a contract managed and operated by the EPA where we provide third-party technical assistance to communities. This technical assistance can be community trainings, reviewing documents, supporting the formation of community advisory groups, facilitating community meetings. So it's a really runs the gamut of helping form a foundation of community involvement process. We have a Superfund job training initiative that we formed because we kept hearing communities say, why are you bringing people outside the community to clean up our sites when we have people here who need jobs? So it's a very small pot of money where we work with community partners, local elected officials to develop a job training program that's very specific to the site to hire local folks to clean up the contamination that's there at their site and to give them a skill set that will last far beyond the Superfund site cleanup. We have our Superfund reuse initiative, which is taking some of our sites that are either in urban areas or have a high potential for being reused in a very comprehensive way, working with the community to do visualization of that site, and then developing partnerships to bring in money to help redevelop the site. So it's more than just protecting public health and the environment, but it's creating the site for a future land use that's desirable for the community. And then our just-in-time facilitation, which is a third-party arbitration where we bring in trained mediators to help in dispute resolution with the agency in the community or the potentially responsible party in the community. So the program I work with, the Community Involvement and Program Initiatives branch, houses a number of materials that could be useful to our site teams, but also useful to any practitioner who's working in a community. They're housed on our main Superfund site, epa.gov/superfund/community. You'll find our community involvement toolkit, which is full of about over 40 tools, little short snippets of how to do community involvement. We have a tool on facilitation, a tool on community interviews, on developing communication strategies. We have a wonderful, robust Superfund Redevelopment Initiative website, which has great videos and other fact sheets on how we've done redevelopment at specific sites. And then we have our EPA Community Involvement Training Conference every other year. We had it in August here in Boston, where it's really structured training on how you build staff capacity to do community involvement. So I want to shift gears a little bit and just hone in on community involvement, specifically in the baseline human health risk assessment process. And we'll go forward to, I think, question on the Silver Book earlier. This is the National Research Council's paradigm that they put out in the Silver Book on human health risk assessment. And very similar to what Samantha talked about, what we traditionally see as risk assessment is right here in the middle. So the IRIS program is involved in the effects assessment, and they give us reference doses or reference concentrations or cancer numbers that we as a program office use in a full-blown risk assessment. What I find very interesting about the NRC's risk assessment process is that it's very robust. It starts with more of a planning and scoping and problem formulation phase. You move into a risk assessment and you get into informing decisions, but throughout the whole process is this interactive public community stakeholder involvement. And we feel like we've had this kind of structure in the Superfund for a number of years, but it was really great to have the NRC pointed out that this is how you do a robust risk assessment. So going back to our Superfund technical milestones, the baseline human health risk assessment starts during the remedial investigation and feasibility study. So after a site is listed, when we're trying to understand the scope and the extent of contamination at the site, when we're trying to understand what's feasible as far as cleanup options at the site, that's when we also do a baseline human health risk assessment. And this is the part of the phase where we go out and we do community interviews, we develop community involvement plans. There's a lot of iterative work with the community, or there should be a lot of iterative work with the community. And as I mentioned earlier, we talk about risk assessments being more realistic, more reasonable, and more comprehensive when the community is involved. It's because the community can assist the agency in answering questions that we don't have answers to. So who may come in contact with the site? Are children on the site? Are elderly? Do we have pregnant and nursing women? How often are they coming in contact with the site? Once a year? Once a week? Do they live on the site? How do people use land on or near the site? Are they fishing? Are they gardening? Are they picking berries? Are they hunting, playing, swimming? How are they using the site? And then also, how do they want to use the site in the future? What types of animals are being hunted or fished? Are they being hunted or fished for subsistence purposes? Do we need to think about protein source replacement if we're taking away that food source? How are they preparing the fish that they're hunting, and, you know, especially fish? How are they preparing the food? And does that create more exposure pathways to the individuals through food preparation? And also, what types of food are produced in gardens? You know, what contaminants are there, and how are specific vegetables uptaking the contaminants or increasing the exposure to those contaminants because of their own structure of the vegetables if they have a high pH? So it's really going out and talking to the communities that we can start answering these questions. And if we're not talking with the communities, then we're using generic, generalizable information instead of site-specific information. And what we want to do is use site-specific information to make a very accurate and reasonable risk assessment. So I wanted to point out just a couple of examples so you kind of get your head wrapped around how we do risk assessment when we're talking with communities. This is an example from Fort Valley, Georgia. It's an older example, but I really like it, where there was a herbicide and pesticide production storage facility right in the community. And what you'll notice, if you can see it, if you're closer, there's a ditch that runs from the storage facility out into the community. And this is where the facility, obviously, got rid of their waste. And when EPA came in, it just kind of looked like this. It was a ditch. And it was only when talking with the community that we realized the ditch went from the facility all the way across town into the creek in the forest. So it was really long pathway of contamination. And what had happened is that the street paved over the ditch. So when there were large rainfall activities, the contamination, the water table would rise, and the contamination would spread. So the community urged the agency to sampling in the yards around where the ditch was. And after much encouragement, the agency finally did, and they found large levels of contamination in the yards. So the site just got bigger because the release was bigger than they originally thought. And that would have never happened without talking to the community about the historic exposure pathway of the site. Same community, same ditch, runs through the community all the way to the creek in the forest. What's really interesting about this community is that there's a type of clay in Georgia that's called kaolin, and locals refer to it as white clay, or white dirt, I'm sorry. And they actually harvest it, dig it up, and they eat it. Some people do, a lot of the elderly in the community. And being a scientist at the EPA, you may not ever wrap your head around the fact that someone actually goes out to a ditch and digs up clay and consumes it. But it was a well-known practice. And that clay happened to be in the creek that happened to bring all the contaminated water from the storage facility. It was an exposure pathway that we could have never dreamt up if we didn't go out and talk to the community. My last example is from Selma, California, where there is a Superfund site that was right next to a vineyard. And so our really wonderful and smart scientists developed a mathematical model to understand the chemical fate and transport of the contamination next to the vineyard into the grapes and into the raisins that was happening. And what happened in talking with the farm workers is that it turned out that the scientists didn't account for the fact that the farm workers, if you work in a vineyard, you pull the grapes off the vines, and then you lay them on the ground kind of on bags to dry out for 2 to 3 weeks to become raisins. And what the agency scientists failed to do is to account for that air exposure in their chemical fate and transport model, the air exposure of the grapes sitting there for 2 or 3 weeks. So in talking with the farm workers, they actually decided to nix their mathematical model and just sample the raisins themselves to get a better or more accurate characterization of the risks that those raisins posed. What I want to do is I got all three of these examples from a really great video that we put together a number of years ago. You can access it too. It's a 40-minute video that explains the Superfund human health risk assessment process in layman's terms, And it shows specific examples of how communities can be involved in that process. And it's got an accompanying presenter's manual, because this video is really pulled together for our site managers to take it out to the communities and talk to them about the Superfund risk assessment and specifically about their site. It also has a 10-minute overview if you feel you don't have the time for 40 minutes, or you want to introduce someone to the process and let them, you know, take the 40-minute video for themselves. So it's available on a publicly accessible website. And we have a number of other resources. We have our risk assessment website in our Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. We actually have guidance on community involvement in Superfund risk assessment. It's guidance, so it's what we're supposed to do on Superfund sites. It's a little old, but it's still very relevant. And then we have a new risk communication tool in our community involvement toolkit. So a couple of resources for you to access.
Thank you. Any questions for Yolanda?
Hi, Lynn.
Yes.
I will try. Our regulations bound us to do Superfund risk assessment on site contaminants. Some people call what we do cumulative, but it's more additive risk assessments, looking at the contaminants for the site, all the pathways of exposure. And there has been discussion about even just focusing on the contaminants of concern for the site, how do we think about background exposure or vulnerability and susceptibility? The best example we have is our lead models that take into effect kind of the daily dose for children, especially of lead exposure, and what's the threshold. Beyond that, we're a little behind on thinking about cumulative risk assessment. But we do it for lead, so there's kind of that window of opportunity.
So you think the opportunity is coming, I mean, especially since the communities are beginning to really ask for it.
Yes, and I can say our center director is interested in it. Sir?
Unless I misunderstood, you've been talking about the community involvement after the site has been selected.
I have been.
And so the question I have then is there any opportunity for community involvement during the scoring process, and then going one step further after it's scored in the selection process as to which sites will be selected for actual EPA activity?
So the question was on the scoring process, which is our hazardous ranking system, and it's a score that's loosely put together by possibility of exposure to contamination at the site. And it's written into our national contingency plan. The structure of it is, we have a guidance document that's being drafted right now on early and meaningful public engagement before the site is listed. So we're working that out. It's something that we're interested in providing more structure or advice to our site teams. It's not out yet. As far as... It's not part of the law. No, it is not. So the law is after a site is listed. So our guidance would just be beyond requirements, the minimum requirements of the law. As far as choosing sites on the process, I mean, that's something that's done by our assistant administrator. I don't really have an answer to your question, but I can speak a little bit more and get back to you on if they have any change in the process to provide for public participation. Mm-hmm. I think we're at time.
Thank you, Yolanda.